It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. Good to have you with us. Here are some numbers to consider.
11,500.
That's how many athletes are scheduled to compete in the Olympic Games.
339.
That's how many medals those athletes are competing to win. And
96.
That's the number American competitors are expected to bring home.
96 of 339
is huge for U.S. athletes. And these Olympics are expected to be even bigger for U.S. media.
1.25 billion.
That's how much NBC has sold in national advertising for the Tokyo Olympics. A record. Which is why you'll have
7,000
hours of Olympic broadcasting to watch from your couch, which is the only place you'll get to see the games because
zero
is the number of live spectators allowed. Although that's not quite a true count because
79,000
officials, journalists, and assistants will be on site with the athletes. Now, these numbers are an unrelenting drumbeat pounding beneath the upcoming games.
15.4 billion.
That's how much Japan has already spent on the Tokyo Olympics, and
365
is how many days these games have already been delayed. A delay resulting from a global pandemic that has claimed at least
4.1 million
lives globally. 4.1 million. Which is why, in a country where fewer than
one-third
of residents are vaccinated,
62%
of Japanese respondents want the Olympics to be delayed, including
6,000
doctors represented by the Tokyo Medical Practitioners Association, who say Tokyo hospitals have no capacity for additional cases. No capacity for additional cases. Which leads us to one last number.
More than 24.
That's the number of Olympic athletes who've already tested positive for coronavirus. And the games don't even begin until Friday. Joining me today is Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Oh, it's great to be here, Melissa.
And also with me is Motoko Rich, Tokyo bureau chief for The New York Times. Motoko, nice to have you on the show again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Dave, let's start with what happens when an athlete tests COVID positive and is either already there at the Olympics or on their way?
Wow. Well, either they're going to be sent home first and foremost, or they're going to be put, if they're already in Tokyo, in a state of isolation, and then they're going to be tested repeatedly. And when I say repeatedly, I mean repeatedly over the course of days to make sure that they're able to compete. Otherwise, they're going to remain in quarantine and sent home. This is a part of IOC President Thomas Bach's Olympic strategy that I would argue is a fiction. That somehow there's this Berlin Wall between athletes, the 80,000 visitors to Tokyo, the coronavirus, and the citizens of Tokyo. A Berlin Wall that I think we're already seeing is filled with holes.
Yeah, and that wall, Motoko, is exactly the concern. Can you talk about what COVID rates are like in Japan right now and how Japanese citizens are feeling about the Olympics being held there?
Well, yes. In addition to the cases that we're seeing recorded both in the Olympic Village and the training area and training camps and among some of the Olympic contractors, cases are spiking in Tokyo just among the general public. So today, in fact, there were more than 1,800 cases, which is perhaps relatively compared to other places in the world, not that high. But for Tokyo, that's a 6-month high. So I think people are worried. It doesn't feel like things are going in the right direction. And there's been anxiety and fatigue, frankly, for quite a number of months. A lot of confusion about what the rules actually are and how the public will be protected. There's a lot of arguments over how the Olympic Committee is going about doing that. So, for example, most of the venues are not allowing spectators, but there was a soccer match played in a venue up in Miyagi Prefecture. And the argument was that COVID is not as bad up there. So as long as they take precautions, it's okay. But I think a lot of people are feeling this sense of cognitive dissonance.
So talk to me about this for a second. What is vaccine access like, Motoko, for Japanese citizens, for those who are living there, if there was no Olympics coming at all? What does vaccine access look like?
Well, that's, I think, part of the problem is that for a rich country, it's lagging far behind in terms of vaccination rates. So the rollout has been very slow and deliberate. And right now, it's just above 20% that have been fully vaccinated. So compared to places like the United States or the United Kingdom, that's pretty low. And so I think that's what's driving a lot of the anxiety and perhaps the spike in cases, is that people are tired of all of the restrictions, so they're starting to go out again, but they haven't yet been vaccinated. So the young have by and large not been vaccinated in Japan. They're trying to get as many people over 65 vaccinated by the end of July as possible. And in Tokyo, I think that rate is actually pretty high among the 65 and over community. But I think for people under that age, there are a lot of people that are still haven't gotten shots yet.
Okay, Dave, I've been trying to really be as fair and open-minded about all of this, in part because, look, I'm an Olympics fan. There's some athletes I really want to see. On the other hand, when I hear these kinds of rates and the sort of inherent life and death inequities associated with this, I'm deeply concerned. I just wanted to point out, last month, during a conference call, NBC Universal chief executive Jeff Shell reportedly said, quote, "Every Olympics has an issue that people worry about in the run-up to the games. I lived in London. Everybody was worried about traffic. Last time it was Zika. But then once the opening ceremony happens, everybody forgets all that and enjoys the 17 days. So, Dave, in what ways is COVID-19 like London traffic?
It's not. That's the main issue. I mean, what a blithe statement that is. I mean, he might as well work for the International Olympic Committee. I mean, what we're talking about is a potential super spreader event being visited upon a largely unvaccinated population with a concentrated urban core during a state of emergency. I mean, of course people are nervous. Of course people are agitated. And I want to say, I was in Tokyo over the summer in 2019, obviously before COVID, doing a bit of a pre-Olympic investigation. And already I found a lot of fatigue among the people of Tokyo with whom I spoke. I'm concerned about the debt and costs of the Olympics, concerned about displacement, concerned about people losing their homes, concerned about the hyper-militarization of public space that comes with the Olympics. And so when you layer COVID on top of that, that's why you get these polls with popping numbers about the number of people in Tokyo who want to see the games postponed, moved, or canceled. I mean, that's the thing. It's like we've never seen an Olympics like this being imposed upon a population that has such resistance to the games actually being staged. So what we're going to be watching on television is effectively a city and a population being held hostage to the Olympic Games.
Is it at all like Brazil? Because I seem to remember talking with you years ago now about a kind of resistance, particularly among the working class and poor folks of Brazil, to those Olympics.
Yeah, no, there was an intense resistance in Brazil, in the communities that the Olympics were being built upon, but it was highly polarized. I mean, you had people in Brazil who saw themselves as being able to profit from the Olympics tremendously, obviously concentrated in Rio, you know, in terms of the business community, in terms of the middle classes in Rio. They saw this as an opportunity to project Rio as a global city. Meanwhile, among the poor, there was a great deal of resistance. In Tokyo, I believe you're seeing something far more widespread, far more of a cross-class, if you will, feeling and sentiment that these Olympics are not worth the cost.
So I'm wondering, Motoko, that sort of final point that Dave said there, that they're not worth the cost. So if we're talking about human health costs, if we're talking about potential loss of human life, but there is a sunk fiscal cost, right? There have been billions already spent, right? Infrastructure already built. Is there any sort of, you know, relatively reasonable argument for saying, look, you know, these are expenses that we have put out as a nation. The only possibility of recouping any portion of this is to go forward.
Well, I don't think they're going to have the opportunity to recoup much of it because international spectators have been banned and most domestic spectators have been banned. So the upside has really already disappeared. I mean, Tokyo, in terms of being held hostage, I think it's less from the sort of debt that the government and the committee and the sponsors have spent than from its actual contract with the International Olympic Committee. That makes it very difficult for Japan to cancel. So I think that's part of the problem. And obviously, there's no way to look at $15 billion, which is the current total spending on this Olympics and kind of say, oh, that's nothing. But again, I think compared to, say, a country like Brazil, Japan is a very affluent country. It's still the world's third largest economy. And so that $15 billion in the context of its total GDP is not as big as it would be for another nation. There also hasn't been quite the level of kind of displacement of truly poor people from the favelas as there were, as I understand it. I wasn't in Rio for the Olympics, but I was reading my colleagues' coverage that there was a lot more displacement of, you know, people in really dire straits. I don't think that's happened quite as much in Tokyo. And certainly the government is making the exact argument that you say, that look, we've already spent all this money, we might as well go ahead. But I think that sort of the costs and the that people are worried about now are human health. And then I think there's just also this kind of sense of being fed up with the lack of transparency, the messaging that's sort of all over the places, the changes this way and that, and the feeling that the government and the Olympic Committee valued the upside profit for the International Olympic Committee from the television revenues and the kind of national pride that the government wants over the human health and happiness and of the community. So I think there's more a sense of anger about that than this kind of worry that somehow Japan's economy is going to collapse because of this.
That's helpful, right? To remember the nation we're talking about, but maybe I'll go to exactly that point, because Motoko, Thomas Box misspoke in a press conference and called the Japanese people Chinese, as though he might not, in fact, know where he was or where the games were about to be played. How has that been received?
Well, everyone noticed for sure. And as soon as he said it, trending on Twitter in Japanese was a hashtag to the effect of what will Bach do next? Kind of making fun of him for his malapropism. And I noticed that at the next press conference where he appeared, I mean, I think someone had probably written a paragraph for him, sort of some cue cards with the words Japanese people written in, you know, block letters. I don't know, but he said those words so many times that I thought he was trying to make up for the misspeaking the other time. But yes, for sure. I mean, and there is a lot of kind of existential angst. The weird thing about the Olympics is one of the arguments that has been made to me by some government officials and bureaucrats and members of the committee and some sponsors is, look, we don't want China to have the title of the first post-pandemic Olympics. And so that was sort of this geopolitical reason for going ahead with these games. And so the fact that then he misspoke and said that, I think, would have touched that nerve.
So, Dave, talk to me about sponsorship and dollars. We were talking a little bit about government spending, but of course, the sponsorship of the Olympics is huge. How significant is it that a company like Toyota is pulling its Olympic advertising in Japan?
That's stunning and stirring. That was one of those moments where I actually did a double take at my computer, because Toyota is one of the major sponsors of the Olympic Games. And the fact that they won't be broadcasting commercials to that effect is really striking. I mean, one reason why sponsors who've been part of building the Olympic Games since 1984, like it's a relatively recent history that sponsors have been part of the underwriting of the Olympics, that they've always loved the Olympic Games because any association with the Olympics tends to burnish the company itself. And so there have been a lot of companies that have more dubious records that have been absolute full-throated Olympic sponsors for the precise purpose that it activates a kind of sin washing of whatever that corporation's sins might be. Toyota is a company that's actually now stepping away from its association with the Olympics, as if that association would somehow hurt Toyota instead of the vice versa dynamic of the Olympics helping Toyota and burnish its own reputation. Also, Toyota, I mean, this is a company that's as Japanese as McDonald's is American. I mean, and so the idea that they're not sort of relishing in the national pride of the Olympics, I think is something that's very striking going forward.
Okay, so I want you to dig into that point with me just a little bit more, because again, in reading your work and talking with you over the years, I always feel like, you know, you've been really climbing up an uphill, a pretty steep uphill incline to make an argument that there are real problems with the Olympics. You know, it's one thing to make that argument about the NFL or the NCAA, but like everybody loves the Olympics. Is this the turning point? Is an Olympics that might have a global pandemic impact the thing that will shift us to focusing on all the various aspects of inequities associated with the games?
Yeah, not just what's happening in Tokyo, but there is already a movement in Los Angeles, which is not hosting the Summer Games until 2028, against the Olympics actually coming to town, because displacement has already started in Los Angeles of the unhoused to create structures for those Olympic Games. My colleague at the CBC, Morgan Campbell, he asked this very provocative question. He said, are we now in a position where the Olympics are not too big to fail, but are they in fact now too big to succeed? And it makes you really think about not only the post 9/11 security concerns, which have raised the costs of hosting the Olympics by billions of dollars, but also now if we're living in a pandemic world, not a post pandemic world, but in a pandemic world, and even more money needs to be poured in to make sure that there's some level of safety that, as we're saying, cannot be guaranteed between the visiting population and the populace itself. And how many countries does that then limit the Olympic Games to? I mean, I think we are headed towards a major turning point. And my contacts inside the IOC say that there are forces in there who know that they can't do the old, 1990s style globetrotting around the world with billions of dollars being handed to them for the purposes of staging the games, that there's going to have to be a major rethinking about how the games themselves are staged in this kind of global economic structure. And we haven't even talked about climate change and the role of the Olympics in putting down a heavy carbon footprint, that there has to be a radical rethinking of how the games are staged if they're going to continue.
What could that even begin to look like?
Well, one thing that some folks are talking about is the idea of, okay, we have to give up the globetrotting. And that's one of the things I know people love about the Olympics. Like, oh, look, we're in Rio. Oh, look, we're in Tokyo. That's certainly what the media loves, Melissa. Like this idea of being able to travel and expense out, and then they glorify where they are and glorify the games themselves. That might need to change. And we need to start talking about a stable location every 2 years. Not unlike how they do the Super Bowl in the NFL, frankly, which has its own problems, but it's usually limited to just a couple of cities because those cities have shown that they have the infrastructure to handle it, and they have the pre-built infrastructure to handle it. That's what's so key, is that there doesn't have to be building these kinds of structures that then have no use value after the games are done. So the idea of there just being one place or just a couple of places around the world where the Olympics are held, I mean, that might be the future that we have to look at.
So, Motoko, as Dave is talking about this, as we're thinking about these multiple layers of security, both a post 9/11 way of thinking about security and now biological concerns around security relative to the pandemic, and then all of these questions about built environment, we heard Bach say that the Olympics are going to require, quote, great sacrifice from the Japanese people. I'm wondering what constitutes the kind of sacrifice that communities are willing to make in order to host these games?
I mean, I think it's a great question. I think before COVID, there was definitely opposition and people who can't understand why the country is spending all this money for very little upside. And I think those questions are not unique to Japan by any means. But I think that as the games got closer, there's certainly like a sizable portion of the Japanese public that was very excited about it, and that the signups for volunteering and for tickets were way oversubscribed. So that's sort of the evidence that people were excited about it. But now I think, the spectators can't go. A lot of the volunteers are sort of saying, well, there are no international spectators and half our job was to show them around town. What are we supposed to do? They're even being told, kind of hide your volunteer uniforms because nobody wants to be associated with the games. So I think people feel like the sacrifice is definitely not worth it because they don't really understand what the point is. And then the possibility that the sacrifice will actually be people losing, getting very sick or even losing their lives. Nobody thinks that that's a sacrifice worth making.
And we're not just talking about the possibility of the people of Japan becoming sick. Is it possible that this could become a global super spreader event?
Well, that's what I've always thought when asking questions at these press conferences and when there's sort of this conversation as if, and I think you mentioned that at the beginning, this idea of this wall, right? That there were only two populations that needed to be protected, the athletes and the participants in the Olympic bubble and the Japanese public. But, you know, it's a global event, right? And so everybody's going to go home and some of them are going to bring something with them, or it's possible that they could bring something with them. So that's always been my concern, is not only is there a possibility of it affecting the Japanese public, is there's a possibility that people will take it home on the planes and spread it all over the world. I mean, people are coming from 200 countries here. So that's a question that I've always asked and wondered about, which is, you know, have those consequences been well thought out?
Dave Zirin is the sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. And Motoko Rich is the Tokyo bureau chief for The New York Times. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and I have a confession. I have more than 100 rolls of toilet paper in my basement, all neatly organized on shelves.
My God.
Now, I'm not proud of the hoarding, but I still just ain't over the great toilet paper panic of 2020. And these days, it's actually pretty easy to find toilet tissue, especially at my house. But you might have a serious problem trying to get a new pair of Air Force Ones. And to understand why, The Takeaway called an expert.
My name is Robert Hanfield, and I'm a professor of supply chain management at North Carolina State University.
He helped us to think about the truly global nature of daily purchases.
More and more of these supply chains have their origins in places like China and Vietnam and Hong Kong and India.
So remember the devastating PPE shortages of the early pandemic? Supply chain.
Because China was dealing with their own COVID crisis over there, they were actually halting the exports of goods from China to the rest of the world. They were stopping those shipments at the border.
And today, the U.S. is not facing a shortage of face masks and plastic gloves, but a consumer supply chain crisis continues. A crisis rooted in the pronounced differences in global COVID infections and access to COVID vaccines.
So, for instance, Nike is having shortages of their running shoes because of the COVID outbreaks in the Vietnam factories. And that's impacting not just Nike, but Adidas and everybody else as well. And by the way, the Delta variant is responsible for shutting down a lot of these factories overseas. They shut down a large port in China. They shut down apparel plants in Vietnam and in Korea.
So the pandemic is not over. And chances are, if you look at the label of your favorite T-shirt or pair of sneakers, you'll find it says, made in a nation whose COVID cases are surging. Here to discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the global supply chain is Tanya Garcia, news editor and consumer retail reporter for MarketWatch. Thanks for being here, Tanya.
Thank you.
So demand is still high, even though we're in a pandemic. How have retailers had to change the supply chain in order to try to meet that demand?
Well, there's some built-in flexibility to a lot of supply chains. It started where there was some changing on where they were going to get their goods. So trying to diversify, whether it comes from China, whether it comes from Vietnam, whether it comes from Bangladesh, trying to add a little bit of diversity to, you know, kind of take the dependency off of one particular place. Now there's really, you know, not a whole lot that they can do. You know, they just try to source from as many places as possible and hope that those sources will come through in the end. So really, we just kind of have to get used to shortages here and there. Where we're going to find them.
Even before the pandemic, there were companies that were trying to do what you're talking about, you know, sort of make their supply chain a little more diversified. Why was this a problem even before the pandemic?
So the problem pre-pandemic was actually tariffs. There was a lot of dependency on China, and there was the whole tariff war going on for some time, and companies were bracing for an increase in price. So to try and keep prices on the lower end of the spectrum, that's where the diversity was coming in terms of sourcing. Then there are, you know, issues that we're facing now with things like, you know, the ports and finding enough truck drivers to physically get things from point A to point B. Some of those things are where companies and retailers, they can try to build in some flexibility and have tried, but there's only so much you can do when there's a global pandemic happening.
So let's talk about not just consumer goods, but food. What kind of impact is COVID-19 continuing to have on the food supply chain?
First, you have the literal picking and packing of food, factories and production facilities. Those areas, they're better now. We had the issues early on in the pandemic where there was illness sweeping through these factories and it was causing an issue. So you always have to be kind of mindful that if there's a resurgence, there could be a resurgence at these facilities as well. But separately, the food supply chain is separated so that there's food that goes to the grocery store and then food that's meant to go to event spaces, stadiums, restaurants. When all of that was shut down, the supply chain had to transition so that that food was going to the grocery store as well, because everybody was eating at home and cooking at home. So now you're going to see perhaps some unwinding of that.
Right. That was in part like the toilet paper story, right? Was that, I mean, part of the reason I have 100 rolls downstairs in my basement is because it's not like fluffy Cottonelle Charmin kind of thing. It's like that toilet paper that you can get, kind of industrial sized, because we had a small business that we were able to order it from. Right. So it wasn't that there wasn't toilet paper. It was that it wasn't going to the home market.
Exactly. So there's a lot of folks who may have noticed when they went to the grocery store at some point over the past, say, year and a half, that some item that they really wanted wasn't there. There's never been an issue of a shortage of food or a shortage of goods. It's just a matter of where it was being placed. And that has to do with the supply chain. The supply chain dictates where items go. And so now that everything is on the road to recovery, or we're tiptoeing back into, regular life, some of that has to kind of revert back so that it goes to the places that we're used to seeing it pre-COVID.
Is there an ethics to consumption now relative to the pandemic? If I know that eating meat will mean that there are workers working in close proximity in meat packing, situations where COVID is happening, or if I'm buying goods from countries where COVID numbers are surging, is it unethical to make those purchases, or should I be making them in order to bring resources to those communities? Like, how do we make ethical choices at this moment?
I think that the past year and a half has brought a lot of issues to light about the way that we live, and supply chain and how we treat workers has definitely been one of those things that has, I think, impacted some consumers. Over the past year, we've seen, combined with COVID, issues with climate change that have come up, and that's also impacting the types of choices that people are making. And when you're making these kinds of choices under the pressure of a supply chain that's being stretched thin, you might find yourself thinking, well, do I need to eat this? Do I need to buy this? What sort of habits did people develop over the past year? And which ones are going to be sticky, as they say? Which ones are going to stick around, once things eventually do get back to normal? And what's going to revert back to, the pre-COVID consumption habit?
Listen, I have a 7-year-old. She was actually asking philosophical questions about the age of Santa Claus the other day. Even though it's July, can you help us parents out and tell us how this might affect the holiday supply chain?
So, toys, unfortunately, for your daughter, toys might be an issue this year. So the supply chain is also really time sensitive for a lot of categories. And so while we may not be thinking of Christmas in July, a lot of companies already are under normal circumstances. And so with the supply chain still having its issues and challenges, we're already seeing from analysts that toys could be an issue come the holiday season. The timeline has been thrown off by the pandemic, and I'm sure that there is a big scramble happening to keep those challenges and those disruptions to a minimum.
Tanya Garcia, news editor and consumer retail reporter at MarketWatch, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is Lawrence Fishburne as Dr. Larrabee in the heartwarming family film from 2006, Aquila and the Bee.
Spell prestidigitation.
I'm sorry, sir, but this girl is only 11 and she's already one. Mr. Welch, what is this?
Prestidigitation. Can you spell it?
P-R-E-S-T-I-D-I-G-I-T-A-T-I-O-N. Prestidigitation.
Back in 2006, when Kiki Palmer was jump roping and spelling her way into our hearts as the fictional Aquila, there was so much that had not yet happened for Black girls. We'd not yet had a Black First Lady. FLOTUS Obama gave us that in January 09. We'd not yet had a Black Disney princess. Tiana premiered in December of 2009. And we'd not yet had a Black woman vice president. VP Kamala Harris made this a reality earlier this year. And we certainly did not yet have a real-life, brilliant, basketball-dribbling Black girl champion of the Scripps Spelling Bee. But now...
Maria. M-U-R-R-A-Y-A.
That is correct!
2 weeks ago, 14-year-old Zaila Avant-Garde won the 2021 Scripps National Spelling Bee, becoming the first African-American girl to do so. But if there is one thing we can learn from all these firsts, it's that firsts are rarely the only. Turns out there's a small but robust community of extraordinary Black girl spellers taking on the world one Latin root at a time. And one tiny, mighty champion lives right up the road from me, right here in North Carolina. Here to talk with me about what it's like to compete in the Scripps National Spelling Bee is Kana Gerald of A.L. Stanbeck Middle School in Durham, North Carolina, and her mother, Dr. Carissa Gerald, who is Assistant Professor of Environmental, Earth, and Geospatial Sciences at North Carolina Central University. Eagle Pride, welcome to the show, to the Geralds.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Kana, I want to start with you. What got you first involved in spelling bees?
So I always loved reading and writing, and I also did a spelling bee in kindergarten, which I won, but it wasn't like a Scripps spelling bee. So I think that's what really pushed me to go and continue going to spelling bees and to continue spelling and reading.
Now, this year, were you in school in person?
I was not.
So you did all of this prep for the spelling bee when remotely and at home?
Yes.
And what was that like? What did a day look like for you?
So I would start off by going to school, and then I would go and I would get my flashcards and my Latin root cards, and I'll turn on some music, and then I'll just be there in there like studying and making sure I know all the words, all the definitions, all of the origins of speech, and having like my mom to the side of me reading off words from the spelling bee list and asking me how to spell the word or like what the root of the word was or what the definition of the word is.
So what kind of music were you listening to?
I listened to K-pop. So I'd be jamming some BTS in the background or some Super M or something in the background.
I love that. I'm completely into that. Kana, I have to say, I smiled when I saw the picture that is on, you know, it's like the Spelling Bee winners photo that is on the middle school website. And kind of poking out of the side is an adorable little head that looks like it's a younger sibling. Are you an older sibling?
Yes, I am the oldest of three. So I have a little brother and a younger sister. And so, yeah, I am the oldest. Yeah.
And were they helpful or distracting when you were trying to study for the spelling bee?
A little bit of both. My brother, he would try to read them off, and then he would get mad at me because I didn't know what the word, like, he didn't pronounce the word correctly. And I'd be like, what is the word? And I'll ask him again, and he'll be like, no, you're saying it wrong. And I'd be like, but I don't know what you're trying to say.
Now, Professor Gerald, I want to draw you in here because it's oftentimes when exceptional young people are in the public eye, you know, folks will sometimes assume, oh, it's really just the parents who are pushing. So, Mom, what has been your role in Kana's spelling success?
I definitely would say that Kana has been proactive herself and really innately pushing herself and, you know, having those driving forces. I have only facilitated at this point. A lot of the words I honestly could not pronounce myself. If it was a science word, I remember autophagy and hemorrhage and some of those. But other than that, she was on her own. But anything that she needed, I tried to make sure she had. We went to the store and we bought all kinds of highlighters and gel pens and index cards, Latin root word. Index cards with the different pronunciations, suffixes and prefixes, and all that kind of stuff. I took a medical terminology class a long time ago at NCANT, and so I remembered all that stuff, and I said, wow, she probably needs that. So I just brought all that kind of stuff back into remembrance and said, hey, let me just fill her up and pour into that picture as much as possible so that she would be able to, you know, have those opportunities. So really, it's mostly her. I just make sure that whatever she's trying to do, she has everything or any resource that she needs to complete it.
I love that. Kana, you made it to the Scripps National Spelling Bee after you won your regional bee, and you made it all the way to 139th out of 209, which is a really big deal. How did it feel for you?
I was very surprised. I didn't think I would be able to do something like this. I was also very nervous, but like because it was a lot of pressure, I think, coming from like learning different words that you maybe have like never heard before or words that weren't even English. And then I was also proud of myself because I went to the National Spelling Bee. And again, that was something that I never thought I would be able to do.
Talk to me about sort of what kinds of things you need to know in order to learn to spell. I think some folks feel like it's just memorization, but this sounds like it goes way beyond that.
So I think you need to learn more about different languages. I'm not saying go and like become fluent in a different language, but I am saying you should go and look at some of root words and the origins of where most of like the root words come from. So if you have like something that isn't Japanese and then you go and it's in Roman and it's romanticized and then you look at the root for that. And then if you have something that's in Greek and then you translate it and then you look at the root for that, then that's how you can figure out what the word means, or at least infer what the word means, and tell how to use it in a sentence.
Okay. I love just hearing you talk about the roots and then the connections in these ways. Did you learn any of this from your mom, who seems like she knows an awful lot about the world and how it works? She's got a pretty extraordinary academic record herself as a professor. Like, have you been, as a young person and maybe really oldest in your family, watching your mom and thinking, all right, I've got a big brain like that?
Yeah, it does definitely come from my mom. I think she has always been like a role model to me. So I've definitely learned a lot of these things from my mom.
Dr. Gerald, how's that feeling for you as a teacher and as a researcher to hear your daughter speak in these ways?
It's heartwarming. It's so heartfelt. I don't want to cry, but I'm thankful for her. And I'm thankful that, you know, I could be in this field, in this area of expertise, and be able to pass that along to her. It makes me feel so awesome. I am warm and fuzzy all inside.
Kana, talk to me a little bit about the actual Scripps Spelling Bee, which is kind of like an Olympics for spellers. What was the hardest part and the best part?
The hardest part was learning all of those words and learning different origins. Even though it may seem easy, it's a lot of different word parts. So learning the different origins of speech and learning about different words and the different definitions was very hard, especially when a word has like a homonym or like a homophone. It's like, oh man, I don't know what that is. But then I think the best part of the spelling bee was meeting new people who also enjoy reading in words and learning about different words. Like, you get to learn about different words from other cultures and from other places. And now you have something to add to your vocabulary that you can use when you're just talking to someone.
Do you talk like a spelling bee champion when you're just like talking to your friends and listening to K-pop?
Not really, but I think sometimes I like to spring in big words to like to like mess with them a little bit.
I love that. Were your friends back home who are maybe not spellers? Because I have to say, there's different ways to be brilliant and different ways to be great. And folks may be brilliant in all kinds of things, but not be good spellers. So you might have great friends who just are not good spellers, but were they like rooting for you? Were they in your corner during all of this?
They definitely were. My one friend, she took a picture of me on her TV and she sent it to me. And I was like, oh my goodness. She was like, yeah, she was cheering me on.
I love that. And what are you doing these days since you're not practicing for the Scripps Spelling Bee?
I currently am in summer camps. So I had a 2-week summer camp in Ag Discovery that was hosted by Fresno State in California. And I learned about strawberries and the different agriculture that naturally grows in California and how it contributes to their economy. And I am now currently in a Step Up to STEM science camp, and I'm learning about spectrometers and light and how red absorbs the green light and how blue and all that absorbs orange light. And then I've been playing piano for a while, so I'm going to be continuing on that and making sure that I stay up on my piano.
So, Kana, you talking about strawberries and ag camp had me misting up. For folks who've been listening to the show this summer, they'll know I live on a couple of acres here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I've got the chickens and the ducks and all the vegetables growing. And I got to say, Dr. Gerald, when I saw your bio, and then one that you grew up here in Winston-Salem where I live, that you're a North Carolina A&T Aggie and currently teaching at North Carolina Central, two of our foundational Black colleges here, and that you did your undergrad degree in animal science, I just kind of feel like I just want to sit around and farm with y'all.
Yes, please come on down. Come on down. My fiance actually has a farm and he has chickens and we have eggs and all that. So yes, please come on down.
Okay, listen, collaborate.
I love it.
This is happening. So first of all, y'all come down to Winston. We'll hang out with my chickens. I'll come up to Durham. I'm going to hang out with your chickens. This is just, it's going to be like a chicken festival, but we're not going to have our chickens hang out with each other because that's bad biosecurity. Kana, I want you to talk to me a little bit about high school. So I keep introducing you by your middle school name, but you're heading off to high school in the fall. Where are you going? And do you have any big plans?
So I'm going to be going to Cedar Ridge High School. I am very nervous. I don't know. I don't know if I want to go, but I guess I have to. So I'm very nervous about that. My big plans, I want to try to get into a robotics club. So I'm going to try to do that. I'm going to continue to read more because I love to read. So I'm going to try to find some new books and look for some more things to read. I'm going to continue learning new words, as always, because learning new words can open many doors for you. So, yeah.
I love that. And don't be nervous. I think there's a whole lot of us who've got your back as you go off to high school. I have one last question for you. And we started by talking about like the fact that in 06, when Akilah and the Bee came out long before, I know 06 must seem like the beginning of time to you. But now we have a real life Black girl who is the Scripps Spelling Bee champion. What does that mean to you?
I am very, very proud of her. She represents everyone in the Black community. She represents all girls, all Black people. I think that what she did was awesome. I would like to say congratulations to her if she's watching. I'm very like kind of surprised, but not at the same time because she is very brilliant, but surprised because I never seen this happen, and now I'm like a part of history that I never thought I would ever be a part of.
Kana Gerald, who is a part of history and I'm sure will continue to make history, and to Dr. Carissa Gerald, who is my new professorial poultry buddy here in North Carolina, assistant professor of environmental, earth, and geospatial sciences at North Carolina Central University. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
We're wrapping up, but just one more thing, y'all. I want y'all to listen to the plans that our 14-year-old national Scripps Spelling Bee champ, Zaila Avant-Garde, has for herself. This is Zaila talking with local New Orleans Fox 8 TV.
I have a variety of things I'm interested in. I'm definitely interested in playing basketball at Harvard. Then it's like four options. Like I'm thinking about maybe an NBA basketball coach, working for NASA, or maybe treating diseases and stuff with the help of neuroscience.
So listen, y'all, be like this, curious, ambitious, and ready. And speaking of all them good things, I have to take a moment to shout out Polly Irungu. For 3 years, Polly has been our digital editor and our family. She started Black Women Photographers, a global community and directory of Black women and non-binary photographers, and wants to pick up the camera herself again. So Polly, thank you for everything you've done for us. We're going to miss you, but we wish you nothing but success. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.